This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today. Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolios strive to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Sorting fact from fiction when it comes to healthcare. Hi, this is What's Health Got to Do With It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a local neurologist that practices at the Mayo Clinic, and thanks for listening. And just ahead, we'll take a look at some of the myths surrounding your favorite indulgences. Then we'll sift through the world of information about CBD products. Later, a look at how regular exercise can benefit your health. But first this hour, wading through conflicting health information starts with understanding how to spot misinformation. With the arrival of the pandemic came an explosion of misinformation about the disease. As the COVID-19 pandemic spread, social media outlets emerged as both an important means of socializing as well as a critical way to share information about the disease. In the process, this enabled the amplification of unchecked information and the spread of health misinformation. An NBC News analysis found that most viral pieces of fake health news pushed far-reaching conspiracies between governments and medical communities and suggested ditching common medical treatment of life-threatening diseases like cancer for unproven cures. The top 50 articles garnered more than 12 million shares, comments, and reactions this year, mostly on Facebook. Fast forward to where we are now, health misinformation is everywhere. Social media platforms have put in some guardrails, but not enough. So how do we navigate this? Here now with more on the subject is Dr. Christy Roschke, Managing Director of the News CoLab, an initiative aimed at helping people better understand how news works at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State University in Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Roschke, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we'll get right into this, and I'll just ask the most basic question. How did we get here?
Oh boy. Well, this is a long time coming. You know, it feels like these are all very recent and new problems, and certainly we're feeling them very acutely now. But I think misinformation has been a problem as long as there has been information. Information makes us feel emotional. It can make us feel vulnerable. And when we add on top of that platforms and technology and cultural context that exacerbates those emotions, it's kind of a breeding ground for misinformation.
You know, one of the things that everyone has asked me when I said we were going to do a show on this particular topic is, how do you spot misinformation and identify reliable resources?
Yeah, so it can be really tricky, right? Because people who create misinformation can make it look as believable as any other sort of information. So just kind of like being able to spot it with your eyes isn't enough anymore. All information kind of looks the same. So some of the tips I share with my students at ASU include things like reading laterally. That's actually a tip that comes from the Stanford History Education Group, which is when you see a piece of information that seems questionable to you, open another tab on your browser or your phone and Google it and see if you can find another source that's going to corroborate that information. So there's kind of this idea that there's safety and more people talking about the same thing. When it comes to health information, we want to look for trusted experts. So that might be your local doctor or nurse or someone that you work with that provides you care, but it may also be the local medical association or department of public health in your area that's going to have access to the best primary sources and the most current evidence about the thing that you're looking for.
you know, one of the questions that I'm listening to you is that it makes complete sense. Yes, you look things up, but that also means you're going to spend a little bit more time. So I guess my big question is, how do you cultivate this mindset when everything is so digital and fast and quick, in terms of people feeling that they need to look things up a little bit more intensely as opposed to taking it face value?
Sure. I mean, you're absolutely right. And the truth of the matter is that we're not going to take that extra time most of the time. And so one of the things that we can do is, particularly if we're talking about social media, is try to curate and pay close attention to the people that we're following in the first place and make sure they're people that we know, whose expertise we trust. That might make us a little less susceptible to seeing misinformation. But the other thing I think is paying attention to our emotions and our reactions to certain types of information. You know, we all come to information with pre-existing beliefs and biases, things that are going to make us feel really angry or really vindicated. And I think it's when those emotions are running high, it's best to take the extra time, you know, kind of take a step back and say, wait a sec, why am I having this very strong, reaction to this piece of information? And that's probably a good time to double check. Because we're not going to do it for everything. So when it's a topic that's of particular importance to you, or it's making you feel, you know, a pretty strong emotion, it's always a good idea to keep that response in check and say, I feel like there's a reason why I'm reacting to this. So let's go and do a little bit more investigation to see if I'm not just, you know, overreacting to something that's that the content is literally designed to make me have this overreaction.
No, it makes perfect sense. I know if something's important, you're going to spend more time on it. You brought up social media, and that's really kind of one of the big linchpins in all of this. So what are your thoughts on Facebook groups, social media, or Dr. Google, and its role in fake or false health news, if you will?
Sure. Well, so, you know, we're lucky to have access to so much information, but it comes, you know, like Spider-Man says, with great responsibility. With great power comes great responsibility. And we do have that responsibility to make sure that we're looking at content that is credible. And it can be hard to do again, because there's just so much of it. And the platforms not only feed us steady streams of information, but they're sort of algorithmically driven to feed us information that's going to attract our attention. And just because something attracts our attention doesn't mean it's credible. So recognizing sort of the mechanisms behind how we see the information that we see can help us, I think, better identify how this information is using us and how we're using it. And it really takes time to cultivate that sort of skepticism. I like to say it's important to have a healthy skepticism about everything we see. But then we want to, you know, draw back on what is this source, you know, what is it, what is its expertise, what is its intention, what's its purpose, who's funding it? Some of these fundamental questions about where information comes from, and do a little bit of digging when we need to. And then the good thing about health information is that we, you know, most of us do have access to experts, in particular, sure, our own, you know, medical experts, those give us medical care, and we can draw upon them to help verify things when we get confused about what we're seeing online.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Contact your local doctor, who you're talking to, who you trust, I imagine, would be the good sounding board in all of this.
Yeah, I think that can be a good sounding board. And, you know, it's important to remember, though, that not everyone has that sounding board. And so there are sites like the Mayo Clinic has a pretty robust website of different types of, you know, if you're feeling sick and you're looking up your symptoms, go to places that you recognize as trusted medical experts if your only access is advice online.
You know, just this past week, I believe the several media outlets reported that whole issue with the White House offering rap star Nicki Minaj a phone call with a doctor after a controversial Twitter posting she made on COVID vaccine and the reason she refused it. So I guess my question is, like, so what roles are celebrities playing in COVID misinformation, and how do you manage that, given that a lot of people feel they trust that celebrity?
That's right. And, you know, there's a lot of people that trust celebrities maybe over the medical profession for a variety of reasons, or because they're identifiable as influencers in one area of their lives, you know, people translate that to other areas of their lives. And you know, Nicki Minaj certainly has a humongous following online. And so when she says something, that's not rooted in scientific evidence, people are going to take notice. And it's a kind of a great example of what the platforms are designed to do. They're designed to amplify this information because people, lots of people are seeing it and then they're sharing it, and it creates all this controversy, such that then it has to be walked back, and it's kind of impossible to walk back something like that. So interesting, the White House's reaction to that. And it, I don't, you know, I'm kind of conflicted on whether that just draws more attention to the issue or if that was a smart tactic. But I do think you saw a lot of people coming out and saying, you know, we need to think about the influence that celebrities or other people who are not, you know, medical experts or health experts have in these situations. And then the platforms have to decide what they're going to do with that content, whether they're going to allow it to stay up or if they're going to remove it. So there's a lot of tricky questions in a situation like that.
One of the things I'm embarrassed about as a health professional myself is when the people you're supposed to trust locally, your doctors, nurses, and other practitioners, spread information, misinformation. And I'm curious, like, you know, what are your thoughts with regards how the medical industry itself is cracking down on my colleagues in nursing and medicine and other practitioners that spread misinformation themselves?
Yeah, it's really tough because it can kind of, you know, one bad apple sort of can spoil it for everyone. And you know, it's important to remember that you having a certain amount of health or medical expertise in one area, again, doesn't translate to all areas. And so it's as easy for someone who works in the profession to be misinformed as anyone else, maybe potentially. And, you know, I've seen different things about, you know, losing licenses or being put on probation and those kinds of, you know, professional consequences. And I think that those are good ideas to entertain, because we really do want to keep, you know, maintain that semblance of a trustworthy relationship with our medical experts. But again, you know, this is all happening so quickly, and I don't know that there are sort of standard policies in place for this sort of thing. And so I think employers and professional associations are sort of learning as we go, which makes it hard to sort of standardize the reaction. But yeah, when you say, you know, we want to talk to our local experts, that's true. But we also want to make sure that we're talking to experts who have the relevant expertise, and maybe asking those questions of your doctor. What is it that you know or understand about this particular topic? And maybe what you don't know, and who should I talk to if it's not you, might help people from kind of staying in their lane, or keep people to stay in their lane, as they say.
Makes perfect sense, and may I hope that we have less of a problem with this. We have some listener questions that I wanted to convey, and I'll start with the first one is through social media from Nathan in St. Augustine, and he writes, my daughter and her friends are in college, and they refuse to get vaccinated because of fear of infertility from COVID vaccines. I've tried to correct this false information, only to end up in an endless argument. How should I handle false health news among well-meaning people like my daughter and her friends?
Well, that's a great question. And certainly the fertility myth has been making the rounds a lot lately. And I think, you know, sometimes it's hard when you're, especially family, these kinds of conversations can get heated. And so I wonder if in that situation, it makes sense to find out more about where the daughter and her friends are finding this information, and trying to find places that can counter that information that the daughter and friends would find as reliable, you know? So maybe the dad's not as effective of a foil, but if he could better understand how they came to this information and why it's so believable to them, then finding something that can refute that might be a little bit easier, because you need to put yourself in the shoes of the person who's receiving the information. And there's so much context and, you know, just dynamics for different people that lead them to believe certain things. And it looks like something like this, that's obviously very important to the daughter. You know, maybe the dad's is not going to be the best one. So who would be the most credible? And I think asking her that question might help.
So a little empathy, if I hear what you're saying at this point.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I have another question. This is actually from a medical colleague who wants to remain anonymous. And he states he recalls a time when doctors were the primary source of medical information for their patients. He wonders your thoughts on whether our problem with health misinformation is really a sign of an erosion of trust in institutions, either the doctor-patient relationship or perhaps the media-audience relationships.
Sure. So there's a lot of evidence that as a society, even globally, we're seeing a decline in institutional trust kind of across the board. With the start of the pandemic, there was a bit of an uptick in terms of trust in the medical profession as a result of, you know, just being able to get the information you need when you need it. And I think that that remains true. But it is, I think it is a fact that we as people are not as trusting, generally speaking, in institutions, or blindly, I guess, in institutions. And again, that skepticism that I think is a good thing has been sort of bleeding into cynicism for a lot of people. And part of that, and it's not the only reason, but part of that is because there is so much information online that it's very easy to find conflicting information about anything. So whereas institutions tended to be the gatekeepers of credible information for, you know, centuries, that's just not the case anymore. And so when people can find the answer that they're seeking about any topic online, it takes the wind out of the sails of those doctors or other trusted professionals, and kind of how we're defining expertise is different these days. And so I think the parent or the patient-doctor relationship is critical right now. A lot of us don't get to spend much time with our doctors, and that might be part of the reason why the trust is eroding. And so I think getting back to creating a closer relationship with the people that we're trying to care for, and that's true of the media as well, I think is a step in the right direction.
I have one other listener question. They also wanted to remain anonymous in this case. I guess this is a controversial topic for some. But they ask, how should the average person, even doctors, handle it when people ask them about the other side in quotes, when in fact the other side has been disproven? They give an example, for instance, why not give equal footing to discussions on ivermectin in the COVID world, or masks are harmful in the COVID world, and things of that sort. What are your thoughts on kind of giving voice to that other side if that in the sheer chance that there may have a point somewhere there?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that both sidesism of journalism is problematic in a lot of ways, because there's not usually two obvious sides to every story. And a lot of times when we are trying to give equal weight to a story and, you know, to maintain objectivity or neutrality, it is giving more attention to a side, if you will, that has not proven or has been disproven, and that's dangerous. But it does, to your point, lead to maybe some people crying censorship and saying, why aren't you talking about these things? Because, you know, I have this anecdotal evidence, or there's this other conflicting evidence over here that says that it may be worthy. And so it's hard to know when to give equal time to things. But in the cases, some of the cases that you mentioned, you know, when something has been disproven, it's in my opinion, not worthy of the time. And you want to bring it up in a limited way to provide context, but also to explain why consensus says that it's not, you know, ivermectin is not a treatment for COVID, or, you know, to use it instead of vaccines, that's been disproven. And so we don't want to give it the attention that it does not deserve. So it's hard though, because again, like, people can find information that they want to support their claims, which is leading to all kinds of conflicting information. You mentioned empathy a minute ago, and I do think, while it may be a little simplistic, but thinking about people who have different ideas about all of these issues, treating them with empathy and trying to understand how and where and why they're coming to their conclusions, rather than just sort of people shouting down one another. You know, I'm hopeful that would lead to some solutions.
And I think everyone listening and everyone in general just wants to find that element of solution. You know, one last question, and that's the kind of the general philosophical question that I think we started out with the point of talking about this is, where do we go from here?
Boy, that is $1 million question. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we all want to be informed. None of us want to be misinformed. And I think that's important to remember, that no one is actively seeking the wrong information. we need information and we value different types of information at different points in our life for different reasons. And it makes it super complex because it's almost like individualized. And then we have these technology platforms that are either aiding or not aiding that search. And I think that's important to remember that we're all just trying to find good information that can help us lead healthy lives and protect our families. And, you know, I don't think anyone doesn't want that. And so it might be time to try to take a step back and recast this issue in terms of how can we support healthy, you know, lives and healthy information in a way that's not so divisive. I don't have a lot of answers right now, but, you know, specific answers, I guess, but I do think it's important to remember, you know, our shared humanity in this and our desire to be well-informed. I think we all share that.
Yeah. Isn't that something that I think we often forget, the shared humanity of this? Dr. Roschke, I just want to thank you so much for joining us and talking about this like hugely important topic. And I hope as we come out with better answers that you join us for a future show in the at some point.
Thank you so much for having me, and I would be very glad to join you again.
We've been talking to Dr. Christy Roschke. She is a professor at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State University and director of the News CoLab, an initiative looking at how teaching folks how media and news works. Later, CBD remains a popular supplement without much regulation. But up next, caffeine, alcohol, and sugar myth-busting with a dietitian. You don't want to miss that. We'll be right back.
73% of high school students don't get enough sleep. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends preteens get 9 to 12 hours of sleep and teens get 8 to 10.
What's happening? I'm Melissa Ross, and every weekday morning at 9 on First Coast Connect, we connect you to the top newsmakers and interesting people in this community, bringing you up to date on the issues and stories that affect your life. On First Coast Connect, every weekday morning at 9 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a local neurologist, and thanks for listening. When it comes to diet and nutrition, there are what we can call the big three that dominate most of the discussion. I'm talking about sugar, caffeine, and alcohol, which is another way of saying my pandemic diet. Sugar is the most commonly found ingredient in most processed foods. Caffeine is the most consumed stimulant in the U.S. and the world, and alcohol is a close second in terms of popularity of its use. These ingredients are the basis of a multi-billion dollar industry, or multiple industries, and have impacted our cultures and permeated our lives for centuries. The issue, though, is medical headlines seem to claim either a new health benefit or warning about them, depending on the day and the study. So how do we figure out how much to include of these items in our daily diet? So joining us now to help us sort all of this out is Dr. Jeanette Andrade. She is a registered dietitian and director of the University of Florida's Dietetics Graduate Program. Dr. Andrade, welcome to What's Health Got to Do with It.
Thank you so much. Pleasure being here.
We love having you here because a lot of questions on this topic. There's a pervasive mindset that sugar, caffeine, and alcohol are bad. Is this true? Is it kind of a blanket statement?
Well, I am a caffeine lover, so I do not
too.
Want that to be a true statement by any means at all. I think we all have to remember that moderation is the key, right? And so You know, a lot of people will say moderation, moderation, and truly it is the correct amount of moderation depending on, you know, your age, your gender, sex, you know, your race, ethnicity, where you're living and what's going on. Obviously, too much is always detrimental, so we want to just be conscientious of that. But, you know, we hear a lot in the European countries that having a 4-ounce glass of red wine doesn't do any harm. And so I think, honestly, if you're going to do it, you have to do it at small portions and not overdoing it.
So at the end, always start with that, not going too overboard with any of these ingredients, if you will, because of the concerns. So moderation's always the key.
Correct. Yes.
You know, as a general sense, how do these ingredients function in our body? I mean, caffeine, for instance, or alcohol. What role do they play?
Yeah, so caffeine is really a stimulant, right? So you hear a lot where people will say, oh, it's 3:00, my mind is foggy, I got to have a pick-me-up. And so what better thing to have is then a cup of coffee or, and I don't want to go down the direction of energy shots by any means at all, but we usually gravitate towards caffeine at that time. Same thing too is that we may say, oh, those brownies look delicious, I want a bite. And some people may feel a little sluggish after having that, right? So everyone's body works a little bit differently. Alcohol, it works very differently depending on the individual. Sometimes it kind of acts as a sleeping agent where you kind of have a little bit.
True. You
don't feel yourself. Certainly it kind of works with your mind at some times, right? Certainly if you consume too much of it. Alcohol, as any other nutrient, it does have some calories and it is potentially more of a fat calorie. So there's about 7 calories per gram that you're ingesting. So one just has to recognize that if they are drinking some beer and they're saying, I have that beer gut, it's because of the fat content that is how alcohol is metabolized.
Yeah, I know, like when there's a Friday night cocktail, I always say that is the dessert. That is not going to be the main beverage.
Right, exactly, yeah.
I have a few listener questions, and I want to get right to them so that we answer them. A question from Denise in San Marcos. She writes, I'm overweight from the meds I'm taking for depression and anxiety. Like anybody else, I really enjoy that cup of coffee with cream and an occasional cocktail. How do you know if one is consuming too much? Is this about weighing yourself, lab tests, or something else? What's the check that says I'm doing too much?
Yeah, so one thing is I completely sympathize and empathize with this individual because when I worked as a clinical dietitian, a lot of individuals' side effects of the medication contribute to weight gain, which is unfortunate. You know, I certainly don't want to say anything that what she's doing is wrong, and I don't want to say that she shouldn't indulge at some point in time. Measurement is key, though. So if she is consuming coffee with some cream, how much, you know, calories and fat content is in that cream? Is it a tablespoon? Is it 2 tablespoons? You know, what is the serving size? And as long as she sticks within those bounds, she should be doing fine. You know, same thing with alcohol is if she has, you know, a glass Friday evening, Thursday, Saturday, whatever it is, you know, as long, again, is it a 4-ounce serving or is it an 8-ounce serving? So if it's 4 ounces, it's well within what the current recommendations are. So it's just an evaluation of what is that measurement. And sadly, if she gave those up, would she all of a sudden lose weight? I don't know, right? It could be the medications that unfortunately is causing that. And no matter how much exercise and reducing food intake that she does, it sadly may not 100% help.
Another question from Jackie in Nocatee. She writes, every time I go to the grocery store, I'm overwhelmed looking at ingredient labels. So what should I pay attention to? Fat, sugar, or calories?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it really just depends on, certainly if you have a chronic disease, right, then you're going to be focusing on the nutrients a little bit more frequently. I would just say, you know, after being a dietitian for so many years, I kind of have ignored the food labels, which I know is like probably the worst thing that a dietitian should ever say. But at the same time, it's just so overwhelming, right? And so I would just say that when you are looking up food items, obviously we know that fruits and vegetables overall are generally very healthy for an individual. When we're looking at more what we call processed foods, which are your crackers and snack type foods, yogurt, etc. Yeah, yogurt is processed.
Yes.
So when you look at those labels, you know, you really should say, you know, okay, it has sugars. What does that actually mean, though, right? So yogurt has natural amounts of sugars just because of the fact that it is derived from milk. So you kind of have to put into context of what does this actually mean, right? So are we adding a bunch of sugar to it because it's, you know, let's say a Jolly Rancher or something like that, right?
Right.
So that could be an added sugar. Whereas, you know, if you are getting yogurt, then it's like, oh, well, they have strawberries in there. Oh, there's some sugar in there because of the fruit and because of the milk that it's made with, you know. So I would say that it really just depends on what your health interests are. You know, if you are more interested in, am I getting in essential fatty acids, which are the omega-3s, omega-6s, then obviously you want to focus more your attention on the fats. If you are if you are a diabetic or you have some issues with the sugar consumption, you know, certainly you want to look at the added sugars. You want to make sure that you are looking at the total carbohydrates. You want to make sure that there's some fiber in there as well. So, you know, the long-winded way of saying that it really just depends on what your health priorities are.
Right.
And if you are a healthy individual, you know, you're probably doing everything right. And so, you know, focusing your attention too much on the food labels may be quite daunting and overwhelming.
I know it is for me, because that's why no one wants to go to the grocery store with me when I'm examining these things. What are some of the best resources out there to help the average person sort out what I should be doing for myself? What do you recommend to everyone out there with regards to those resources?
Yeah, I would definitely say reputable sources. The USDA has wonderful resources out there, and really they're written at a level that, you know, if you're an expert in nutrition or if you're just new to the field of nutrition, you know, that those are really good resources there. The Mayo Clinic, certainly Johns Hopkins, there's a lot of extension agencies out there, University of Florida, Michigan State. So there's a lot of reputable places that individual can go to that has easy to digest information so that one could really help weigh, should I be focused on this? Should I be looking more at that? So those are great resources. And I would always say, you know, if you have a registered dietitian nutritionist who lives within your area, contact them and ask them, you know, just very simple questions that could help you. Obviously, talking to healthcare providers, physician, nurse practitioners could also provide you with some insight too on where one should be looking at.
This is such important advice. I know so many people had questions. Dr. Andrade, I just want to thank you so much for joining us, and appreciate you coming by and talking to us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. We've been talking to Dr. Jeanette Andrade. She is a registered dietitian and director of the University of Florida's Dietetic Graduate Program. And we'll be right back.
Beware of insurance plans with copay accumulator programs, which is a strategy used by insurance companies and pharmacy benefit managers. This stops manufacturer copay assistance coupons from counting towards your deductible and maximum out-of-pocket spending.
Love British drama? Now get unlimited access to thousands of the very best award-winning British dramas, including a British true crime collection featuring hits A Confession, Honor, and even more chilling crime. Plus, get access to your favorite PBS programs like Flesh and Blood and The Long Song through Jack's PBS Passport Plus. Available from any device, go to jacksbundle.com and activate today.
Welcome back. Cannabidiol, or CBD, is found in cannabis plants. Both hemp and marijuana are versions of cannabis sativa, and they each provide THC and CBD, though in very different amounts. In the last few years, CBD has been touted as the latest miracle cure for everything, from aches and pains to anxiety and sleep disorders. Here in Florida, CBD sales have skyrocketed to become a multi-billion dollar business. I literally can't drive past a strip mall without passing a store selling it. Yet the CBD market in North America largely lacks regulation when it comes to manufacturing and labeling CBD products. So it's important that if you're purchasing CBD, how do you distinguish between premium product versus one that might be questionable or, more importantly, unsafe? So joining us now for a closer look is Dr. Megan Weigel. She is nurse practitioner and owner of First Coast Integrative Medicine. Dr. Weigel, it is a pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks, Dr. Servin. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, CBD remains largely unregulated. So, top question, how can people know they're getting a safe supplement? Is there something in particular that they should be looking for?
Yeah. So the first thing is just don't buy it at the gas station. I think that's a safe place to start. Because, you know, you mentioned strip balls, but truly you can go into gas stations and buy CBD right now. So one of the problems with CBD products is also just the understanding of what is cannabidiol and what is hemp oil. And they're totally different, but they may not be advertised as being different products. They may be advertised for the same uses, which are, it fixes everything, it's safe, it's natural. So I think the first thing is to know whether you're buying hemp oil, which essentially is an omega fatty acid. It's probably going to give you some of the benefits of a plant-based omega fatty acid, or cannabidiol, which is CBD.
Got it.
And one of the problems here is that the CBD product manufacturing sites are not mandated to be FDA inspected for adherence to what is called the CGMP. It's not a weird receptor. It's the current good manufacturing practice regulations.
Right.
And quality standards really vary from state to state. So when you're buying a CBD product, if you're buying a quality product, you're going to be spending anywhere from upwards of $100 to $300 a month. And people may be like, what? The one I got was $30.
Right.
Well,
right.
I would encourage you to call the manufacturer of that product and see if they independently follow the current good manufacturing practice regulations. And if they do, then you can fairly well guarantee that you're getting a product that in each drop has the same amount of cannabidiol. Now we also have to talk about how the hemp is grown, how it's harvested. Is it organic? Do they use pesticides? What kind of oils are they using? What's the expiration date? Because oil can go rancid. So lots to know besides just, oh,
right.
It's here at the health food store. It fixes everything.
Which is the way a lot of folks commonly kind of think about it. I get this question a lot, the one that I have for you here, which is like, what's the best delivery approach for CBD? You mentioned oil, capsule, cream, or gummy. How do you choose that delivery approach?
Wow. So that's a great question. I would say most of the products that my patients are using are probably the drops or the oils. And second line would be a transdermal product like cream. Gummies are not my favorite delivery mechanism for anything because of the other stuff that's in the gummy.
Yes.
And the fact that, absorption might be delayed by those other things, and you might take too many. And that brings me to, with the delivery mechanism, particularly if you're taking it orally, some people may have heard that in a bottle of CBD, there's allowed to be less than or equal to 0.3% of THC. Yes. And so with that being said, depending on the size of the CBD bottle you have and how much you take, it could be similar to taking a few puffs of a marijuana cigarette or eating an edible. And if the delivery, if the quality of the product is not well distributed, it's not a good quality product, then there's an even greater danger of that. So delivery mechanism, from that standpoint, it's even more important to know the quality of the product that you're buying, because if you're going to be ingesting it, you need to know those things. There are some very good quality, very few, but there are some very good quality products that have zero THC in them.
And I guess this brings me to kind of like a question that's related on the THC side. If someone's taking CBD, they have to do an employee drug test or something like that. They want to get a new job. Will CBD cause you to fail a drug test? And then secondly, will it cause you to get high?
So it's possible it'll cause you to fail a drug test. And it's possible, based on what I just said, that it would cause you to get high. It's depending on how much THC is in it and how sensitive you are to that THC. Additionally, CBD is a substrate and is metabolized by two of the cytochrome P450 enzyme pathways that are most used by the drugs we take that are prescribed by our healthcare providers, like proton pump inhibitors, antibiotics, anti-epileptic medications, anti-hypertensive drugs, medications for anxiety, depression, you name it. And the CBD can either increase the metabolism of those drugs or make your body hang on to them longer, and vice versa. So if you're hanging on to CBD that has a higher content of THC in it, this kind of goes along to the medical cannabis that's sold in dispensaries as well, then you could have a euphoric effect.
I want to kind of, in our kind of last few moments, who shouldn't take CBD? Is there anyone that you say, you know what, this is just not a good idea?
You know, the blanket answer to that is the person who shouldn't take CBD is the person who's trying to use it to get off all of their medications that have really good evidence that they're working for them. And assuming that CBD can take the place of those things. Additionally, people who already have liver dysfunction, CBD can cause liver dysfunction. So if you already have it, you really shouldn't take it. I think that it truly, although it's a supplement, like many supplements that I use in my practice, it requires an informed consent and a risk-benefit conversation.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
And if you are on, you know, a lot of medications, consider this another one and have a conversation with your healthcare provider just as you would if they were going to write you a new prescription. Is it safe for me to do this?
It is such huge, important advice, and I can't stress it enough. Always have take a look at where this fits in. Dr. Weigel, I just want to thank you so much for joining us. This has been incredibly helpful.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to Dr. Megan Weigel. She is a nurse practitioner and owner of First Coast Integrative Medicine. And we'll be right back.
The human heart beats 30 million times per year.
Welcome back. This is What's Health Got to Do With It, which examines where and how healthcare intersects with your life. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a local neurologist that practices at the Mayo Clinic, and thanks for listening. Most doctors will tell you the key to good health and long life is diet and exercise. This advice seems simple, right? Well, plenty of research suggests that people who are active outlive those who seldom move. A 2018 study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention concluded that about 10% of all deaths among Americans 40 to 70 years old are a result of just too little exercise. Yet with training plans available on every corner of the internet, each promising the best results, how can we know what type of exercise is best? Well, to help us dissect that and kind of set us straight is Nicole Williams. She is a certified personal trainer with the National Academy of Sports Medicine and owns Nicole W Fitness. And she's here with some tips we can do to maximize the benefits of an exercise program. So, Nicole, welcome to What's Health Got to Do with It?
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm going to get right into it, and I want to know, what are the pros and cons of cardio and strength training?
So I think that cardio and strength training, they both have a place in everyone's life, honestly. In any fitness routine, I think every person should have both of these in it. Cardio is great for heart health. I think most of the population knows that. But it doesn't need to be the only form of exercise that a person does. You can just start by walking. Walking is great cardio. You don't have to do sprints. You don't have to run tons of laps around the track. If the goal is weight loss or body recomp, resistance training needs to be the priority along with a nutrient-dense diet. So when it comes to weight training, I feel like everyone should be weight training. It helps with balance, mobility, overall health, mental health, immunity, body composition. It just sets everyone up better for the aging process.
So it's like the end all be. It sounds like it's such a huge basis for all.
It really is.
I know there's a lot of questions that always comes up about consistency. Is it more important to do something daily consistently, or is a couple of hard workouts a week all you need? Because some workout programs claim you can see improvement in 20 minutes a week.
I'm all for consistency. You want lifestyle changes, because if you're just going to go from nothing to a ton all at once, I mean, I know it's 20 minutes a week, but 20-minute hardcore workouts, you're probably going to dread them. It's not really going to get into a routine. If you're brand new to working out, start with daily walks. You don't have to go 5 days a week. It doesn't need to be all or nothing. Sustainable changes are what matter in the long run.
Are rest days important in terms of having that somewhere involved in this? Like, is it, even if you're consistent, that there's some days you take a rest on it?
Oh, 100%. So during your actual workout, you're not building muscle. I know a lot of people think that, but you're actually building the muscle when you're resting. Because when you're working out, you're creating small microscopic tears, which is totally normal and fine. But when those heal, that's how the muscle gets stronger and grows. So yes, you definitely need to be taking your rest days.
Do some people's bodies just respond better to some workouts than others? And how do you find out which is the right one for me, or who's the best person to ask?
So no matter who you are, genetics will always play a role to some degree. Everyone is a unique case, and I treat everyone as such. What really matters is if you enjoy your workouts or not. If you hate what you're doing, you're probably not going to stick to it, and you're probably not going to see results. But if you enjoy what you're doing, there's a greater likelihood of you continuing with it. So results, no matter who you are, it's going to take time.
I have a listener question, and this is from the beaches, and they write, how does yoga measure up to other forms of exercise? Is it an either or is it something to add on? Where do you place that?
I like yoga for balance and for mobility and for more of a, I mean, you can do a hard yoga class for sure. It's more stretching to me and kind of meditative. but I'm all for yoga. If someone enjoys yoga, go for it. It will definitely help with your mobility and flexibility.
You talked earlier about mental health benefits along with many others, but can you kind of elaborate a little bit more for us? What are the mental health benefits of just exercising in general?
Well, exercise has been shown to relieve depression and anxiety, stress. It gets those endorphins flowing, so it makes you feel better. Exercise really just has the potential to change your whole mood, honestly, and it boosts confidence.
How long should someone exercise before they see those benefits?
Just start. It doesn't take, or it doesn't need to be a crazy amount. Just start walking, start getting outside more, and even just with 30 minutes a day, you'll start seeing health benefits. And then moving more throughout your day as a whole will also help with those benefits.
Nicole, I just want to say that these items and pieces of advice are terrific. And in general, I want to make sure that I give you the opportunity to kind of give out your take-home message, if you will, to our listeners out there with regards to exercise.
Okay. So my take-home, what I tell all my clients is just start somewhere. And let's work on small changes over time that we can build on, and results will come. It doesn't need to be a big stressor for you. Fitness should fit into your life. It shouldn't consume your life. And just be patient. Trust the process.
You've left me with those two words, get started. So words that I'm going to try to live by. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us. So I really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's our program for today. If you missed anything, you can catch the rebroadcast tomorrow at 9 p.m. or listen to the full program at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests and social media participants. Our senior producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our associate producer is Catherine Hobbs. Have questions or comments or medical question or topic idea for a future show on what's health got to do with it, call us at 904-358-6362. Send an email to health@wjct.org or tweet me @JServin. Our upcoming episodes will include a physician's roundtable on the hottest healthcare news, breast cancer, and generic versus name brand pharmaceuticals. And we want to hear from you on these topics. Give us a call. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening and keep in touch.
This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today.